FS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Joining us on the show today is Richard Duncan. He's the publisher of MacroWatch, a video newsletter at richardduncaneconomics.com. And I want to ask you about your recent presentation that you gave to a group of investors here in the U.S. Richard, tell us, why are interest rates so important in terms of what's going to happen next with the U.S. economy and the U.S. stock market as you see it?
Okay, Chris, thank you for having me back on the show. It's always nice to talk with you. So interest rates are really the key to what's going to happen to the global economy and the U.S. economy going forward. Since the early 1980s, interest rates have come down from nearly 20% down to now the 10-year government bond yield is 2.5%. And as interest rates came down, credit became more affordable. And so the Americans borrowed more. And as they borrowed more, they spent more. So the credit growth drove the economic growth. And we've seen the ratio of total debt to GDP in the country, or total credit to GDP, go from roughly 150% of GDP in 1980 up to 350% now. And that was only possible because the interest rates became lower and lower, so the credit became more affordable. And as credit expanded, that credit growth drove the economic growth. But now, if interest rates begin to move higher, then credit's going to contract, and that's going to throw the U.S. back into severe recession. Because what we've seen is any time that's been less than 2%, going back to 1952, the United States has gone into recession. And it didn't recover from that recession until there was another very big surge of credit growth. So if we get a spike in interest rates, then we're going to have a sharp contraction in credit, and that's going to throw the U.S. and the world back into severe recession. That's one reason. The second reason is asset prices, stocks and property. They are also very inflated. If you look at household sector net worth, that's how much the households own, normal people, how much they own less, how much debt they have. It's spiked up to $90 trillion now. That is 60% more than it was at the worst point in the crisis in 2009. Is $35 trillion more than it was in 2009. And the reason asset prices have gone up so much is because interest rates were cut to practically zero and the central banks pumped out enormous amounts of new paper money. And that pushed up asset prices. So there's one way of looking at this that shows that asset prices are very inflated relative to income. There's a ratio called household sector net worth as a percent of personal disposable income. In other words, you can think of this ratio as a ratio of wealth to income. Now, again, going back to 1950, this ratio of wealth to income has averaged about 525%. But in the NASDAQ bubble, it went up to 600%. And then the bubble popped and it crashed. Then during the property bubble, it went to 650%. And again, the property bubble crashed and this ratio corrected. And now, well, it's back to 650% again. And what that's telling us is that wealth is very stretched relative to income and very vulnerable to a correction. The wealth has gone up a great deal because of super low interest rates and quantitative easing. Now, if interest rates go up, then the stock market's going to fall, property prices are going to fall, and that's going to create a very significant negative wealth effect that will drag the U.S. economy back into the severe 2008-style recession. Or worse. So that's why interest rates are so important.
And I should mention that we are going to have this presentation available on our site where this interview is located, Financial Sense. So if any of you want to take a look at these slides and the data that we're going to be discussing today, I would definitely encourage you to do so. And Richard, going back to what you said with household net worth, you can clearly see from the chart there that we are at the highest levels we've been with that data back to 1951. So it would appear that we're hitting some upper limits at this point in terms of how much wealth people hold relative to their income. If we go higher, we're clearly going now into uncharted territory. Is that correct?
That's right. And the reason that there is a relatively constant ratio between wealth to income is because if asset prices go too high, in other words, for instance, if home prices go too high relative to the income of the public, then the income that people earn is just not sufficient to pay the interest on the inflated asset prices, to pay the interest on the debt that they have to borrow to, for instance, finance their home. So there is some relatively constant ratio between wealth to income. And that's why this ratio is particularly stretched as it is now. Then that tells us that we're vulnerable to a significant correction in asset prices, such as stocks and property.
Okay. And so going back to what you said, a lot of this goes back now to interest rates, because as you pointed out, interest rates have been falling now. They've been in a long-term decline for quite some time. And that has allowed us to ramp up leverage to borrow significant amounts and continue to increase our borrowing because interest rates have fallen lower and lower and lower. So we have a lot of leverage. And as we know, when there is excess leverage, the smallest change in interest rates can have dramatic effects. So that's really, it seems to me, the main point that you're making here with why we need to look at interest rates and why that's so important in terms of the future outlook, not just for the U.S. stock market, the U.S. economy, but for the global economy as a whole.
Well, that's right. And I think it's particularly of importance at the moment is what President Trump proposes to do with his economic policies. Let's begin by looking at the U.S. government's budget deficit. It's already projected to be $520 billion a year on average over the next 5 years. Now, this is before Trump's policies are put into place. So if President Trump does cut taxes, that's going to mean less government income. But at the same time, he intends to spend more government money on the military and on infrastructure. So it's pretty safe to assume that with less revenue and more spending, the U.S. budget deficit is going to become significantly larger. Now, it's anyone's guess as to how much larger, but I would say it's a fair assumption to assume it's going to blow out to at least $800 billion, if not $1 trillion. Now, that won't happen this year, but potentially next year. So what that means is when the government borrows more, all other factors being the same, that tends to push up interest rates. Because if the government borrows more, then there's more demand for money, and that pushes up interest rates. So that's the first thing to be concerned about. But as I said, this used to be referred to as crowding out. When the government borrowed more, had larger budget deficits, it pushed up interest rates, and this crowded out the private sector. So the higher interest rates prevented the private sector from borrowing because it made borrowing less affordable, all other things being the same. But in recent decades, all other things haven't been the same. There's been one very significant change, and that has been the United States has experienced very large capital inflows starting in the early 1980s. And those capital inflows are related to the U.S. current account deficit or the trade deficit. So let me explain. Every country's balance of payments has to balance. So what that means is that when the United States has a $800 billion current account deficit, as it did in 2006, then it will also have a $800 billion surplus on its financial and capital account. Or in other words, it will have $800 billion of capital inflow. And so what we've seen since the Bretton Woods system broke down in 1971, up until then, trade between countries balanced. And capital flows between countries were relatively balanced. But the Bretton Woods system broke down in 1971. And not long afterwards, in the early 1980s, the United States started running large trade deficits, large current account deficits. And that meant that these had to be offset with large capital inflows. So by the mid-1980s, the U.S. current account deficit was 3.5% of GDP, and that meant the capital inflows in the United States were 3.5% of U.S. GDP. And by 2006, the current account deficit had blown out to $800 billion in that 1 year. That was 6% of U.S. GDP. So that year, we had capital inflows into the United States of $800 billion. So these capital inflows are central to the explanation as to why the U.S. economy blew into a bubble. With so much capital pouring into the country, it pushed up bond prices and it pushed down bond yields. It pushed down interest rates, and that allowed credit to expand excessively. It also pushed up other asset prices like the stock market. So we experienced the economic bubble in 2006. Now, looking ahead, though, the point really is this. If these capital inflows made it possible to finance very large government budget deficits at low interest rates, but now President Trump has pledged to eliminate the U.S. current account deficit. Last year, the current account deficit was about $500 billion. That meant we had capital inflows into the United States of the same amount, about $500 billion. That was roughly enough to finance the entire U.S. government's budget deficit last year, which was also roughly $500 billion. Now, if President Trump eliminates our trade deficit and brings the current account balance back into balance, and he's also going to eliminate the $500 billion of capital inflow into the country. So if we have much larger government budget deficits on the one hand, and at the same time, we have much smaller capital inflows into the United States because of the elimination of the current account deficit and the capital inflows that result from the current account deficit, then it's going to make it much more difficult to finance the U.S. government's budget deficit at low interest rates. In other words, we will have crowding out. It will push up interest rates significantly, and that will cause credit to contract, and it will cause asset prices to crash.
Okay, let me just play devil's advocate for a moment here, because it seems that most people have, let's say, the narrative around why the stock market has shot higher after Trump was elected was because of his pro-growth policies. All of a sudden, investors woke up to the fact, now Trump is elected. That means that we're going to see taxes reduced on corporations, on the wealthy. There's going to be deregulation, which has been choking small businesses. He's pro-small business. He's going to be spending on infrastructure. And so this is going to lead to higher corporate earnings, better economic growth. We have seen a turn in economic growth so far, so I should at least point to that. And that really took place even, I would say, a month or two before Trump was elected, but it's seemingly accelerated now in the wake of Trump's win. So that is a good thing. How do you put some of these things that we've seen and perhaps, you know, what investors believe to be a pro-growth administration and even some of the money that would be coming back into the U.S. should we see a reduction in corporate taxes? How do you put those things in the context of more of some of the problematic aspects that you're focused on in terms of seeing a spike in inflation and how that would lead to a collapse as you see it? So do you mind putting those two things into context for us?
Right. Well, so what you just described largely there, most of what you described was a large fiscal stimulus package, cutting taxes combined with increased government spending. That is fiscal stimulus. Now, that used to be considered a bad thing to do, something that Republicans in Congress were entirely opposed to any kind of stimulus, much less fiscal stimulus. But that's exactly what you've described. Less taxes on the corporations, but at the same time, more government spending. So less money coming in and more government spending going out. That's certainly fiscal stimulus. And fiscal stimulus always creates more economic growth. So there's no question that those policies taken alone will create more economic growth. When the government borrows more and spends more, as President Reagan did during his term, President Reagan was known as a deficit hawk. But when he became president, he did cut taxes and he did increase government spending. And he had budget deficits that were the largest in peacetime history, roughly 5% of GDP for 5 years in a row. So Trump is proposing to do something similar, cut taxes on the corporations and the wealthy, and to increase government spending. So as a result, the government borrowing each year will be very significantly higher than it is currently expected to be. It's currently expected to be $500 billion a year. It might double to $1 trillion a year. So the national debt will increase very sharply. So yes, that fiscal stimulus will certainly drive economic growth in that respect. So let's just be clear about what we're talking about. We're talking about massive fiscal stimulus. Now, secondly, in terms of removing the regulations, so the tax cuts for the corporations, yes, that will improve their profitability. But essentially, it will be the government borrowing to finance the tax cuts or to finance the spending that will go on anyway that will pay for those cuts in corporate taxes. It's not as though the government is going to cut taxes on the corporations and then also cut spending as a result of the drop in revenues. It's going to continue spending and, in fact, spend even more. So the government's essentially just financing the corporate tax cuts, which will boost the corporate profits, which is why the stock market, one of the reasons the stock market has gone up. Another reason the stock market has gone up is the banks have done very well because it appears that the Trump administration intends to repeal a great deal of Dodd-Frank. So instead of allowing the bank regulations to go through to try to curtail the excesses that contributed to the crisis of 2007 and 8, they're essentially removing most of those shackles on the banks so that they can once again go back to speculating wildly with the deposits of the depositors, and also with far fewer constraints on how they can use derivatives and the amount of margining that is required for them to put up on their derivative accounts. It's essentially, yes, it's back to the Wild West world where the banks are free to speculate as wildly as they choose. And that certainly will boost their profits for a number of years. And it could also stimulate the economy as they pump in more credit. The problem is that is likely to take us back to where we were in 2007, where we get a new bubble and then the bubble implodes. All the banks fail again. They have to be bailed out with massive government intervention again. And the bank's management walks away with enormous bonuses from all the profits they created during the bubble years, none of which they have to return when the bubble pops. So yes, the policies in that respect, if you look at what you described, that explains why the stock market has gone up. Lower taxes on corporations, lower regulations on the banks so that they can create a new bubble. But the stock market is not yet taking into consideration the negative consequences that would result from higher interest rates. They factored in the positive benefits, which may come through first, but they haven't considered the negative consequences of higher interest rates, if in fact we do get higher interest rates. Now, if you look at Trump's proposals to put a 45% trade tariff on Chinese goods, and what is it, 30-35% trade tariff on Mexican goods, or more recently, there's been a great deal of talk about a 20% border tax on all imports into the United States. Well, clearly, those policies are going to be extremely inflationary. The United States imports $500 billion of goods from China every year. So if you put a 45% tariff on those goods, all of those goods are going to be 45% more expensive, and you're going to immediately get a significant spike in U.S. Inflation rates. And if inflation rates go up, then interest rates are also going to go up, because no one's going to want to lend you money at 5% interest a year if the inflation rate is 8% a year. So we're in real danger of having a very significant spike in inflation and in interest rates if President Trump does what he said he would do and puts up trade barriers and trade tariffs to bring the U.S. trade back into balance, to bring the current account back into balance. So if we see that, then the asset prices, as I described earlier, will plunge because they're already so stretched. And that will create a big negative wealth effect that will throw the economy back into severe recession.
You know, Richard, I think it's important sometimes to think about, you know, what's likely versus what could happen. And, you know, as you noted earlier, President Reagan, he was known, and perhaps his campaign was somewhat launched off his idea of him being a deficit hawk. But then when he actually entered into office, it was just the opposite, that we saw the deficit expand. We saw a lot of spending. Of course, there was the Cold War at that time. So we saw a lot of spending in the military. And economic growth ensued during that time. You know, we saw a large amount of economic growth. And as you noted, that goes back to the fact that there was fiscal stimulus being injected into the economy. Do you think that we're looking at a repeat of that with Trump? Because I think, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on when a new person enters office on all these different changes that they're going to make. And a lot of times they are limited by forces that are outside of their control, right? I mean, specifically, we're talking about the United States, the way that our government is structured, the branches of government are divided. There are limitations on the powers that can be exercised. So, you know, Trump may have run with a lot of sensational rhetoric in terms of all of these different things that he would do to appease each of the groups that he spoke to. And that's natural for any president. But then again, when it comes down to it, how much of this do you think he's actually going to act on? Because, you know, from my standpoint, it seems that there is going to be some understanding now, I hope, that, you know, if you do launch all these trade tariffs or if you take a lot of these protectionist measures, there are going to be some bad consequences. And I mean, there's so many people out there that discuss this, and we can look at history, how that has led the globe in a very bad direction. So, you know, I'm wondering if this is really just a lot of talk, and he will choose to make some decisions here and there in terms of tariffs that may look good and show that he's getting things done and he's achieving what he set out to do, but really it's not taking an axe to the whole global economy.
I think it would be a mistake for us to assume that he's not going to do the things that he said he would do, particularly in terms of the trade, where the president, as I understand it, does have significant authority to act on his own to put up trade tariffs if he so desires. So, yes, of course, people like to be optimistic, and we can hope that he's not going to do many of the bad policies that he promised to implement. But balancing the trade and bringing jobs back to America and putting up a wall, those were really the core themes of his candidacy. And it's hard for me to see him not acting on those. We have Peter Death by China Navarro acting as his major trade advisor. So if he doesn't do something quite harmful to China, it's going to be very surprising. So I think we should not assume that he's going to forget about what he promised to do. We should expect him to do what he said he's going to do and hope, of course, hope that he doesn't. But let's look back in history to see how things have changed. Let's go back to the 1960s. At that time, we were on the Bretton Woods system, and that meant that there were no trade imbalances between countries. So the United States had a relatively closed economy. We didn't have these massive trade deficits that started developing in the 1980s. And when President Johnson then started spending too much government money on the Vietnam War and on the Great Society programs at home, this led to larger than normal budget deficits, government budget deficits. And those overstimulated the U.S. economy, and they led to inflation. Inflation started going above 4%, I think, in 1966. And at that point, the stock market stopped going up, and the stock market couldn't break above 1,000 for the next 18 years until inflation came back down. Now, this aggressive government spending, or this excessive government spending, carried on under the Nixon administration. And consequently, the U.S. economy continued to overheat. We had full capacity in industrial production. The steel factories were fully at full capacity. The automobile factories were working at full capacity. We had full employment. So pretty soon we started having price pressures. We started having inflationary pressures in term wages started going up, and inflation picked up in a wage push inflation spiral that really ran completely out of control during the 1970s when we had inflation rates above 15%. Okay, so then Paul Volcker, Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, crushed the high rates of inflation in 1980, 1981. By pushing the federal funds rate, the short-term interest rates, up to nearly 20%. And so the very high interest rates crushed the inflation by creating a severe recession in the United States. Unemployment went up to 10%. It was one of the worst recessions we'd had since the Depression. All right, so then that killed the inflation. And then President Reagan was elected in late 1980. And soon afterwards, he started running very large budget deficits. In fact, his budget deficits were very much larger than Johnson's or Nixon's. But the large budget deficits under President Reagan didn't lead to a new round of inflation. They should have, but they didn't. Why didn't they? Because in the 1980s, for the first time, the United States started running large trade deficits with the rest of the world. As I mentioned, by the mid-80s, it was 3.5% of U.S. GDP. And what this meant was that the U.S. no longer had just a small domestic closed economy with a lot of domestic bottlenecks. We suddenly were buying things in a global economy, and there were no capacity constraints in the global economy. And this is the way it's been ever since. We've had large current account deficits almost every year since 1981 or 82. And this means we no longer have a closed domestic economy. We have a very large global economy. And in our global economy, there are 7 billion people, 2 billion of whom are said to live on less than $3 a day. So what that means is we're not going to hit full capacity in labor for literally generations. There are hundreds of millions of Indians who would be glad to work for $5 a day. So we have an infinite supply of low-cost labor. And at the same time, in our global economy, we, because of China and China's crazy excess investment levels, China has excess capacity, industrial capacity across every imaginable industry on a mind-boggling scale. So we have tremendous global excess capacity of everything. So what this means is if President Trump goes ahead with his policies of increasing government spending and cutting taxes, then this is going to overstimulate the U.S. economy again, just like it did in the 1960s and early 70s, because he's talking about eliminating the U.S. trade deficit. If he eliminates the trade deficit, then we're going to be back in the age of President Johnson, where we had a small, closed economy with a limited amount of labor and a very limited amount of industrial capacity. So this overstimulus of the U.S. economy through increased spending on infrastructure and increased spending on the military, combined with eliminating our current account deficit, that will mean we'll once again have a closed economy with domestic bottlenecks that will very quickly lead to a significant new round of high rates of inflation and much higher interest rates. In other words, we'll quickly be back in the 1970s.
Now, again, because I want to go back to what I said earlier, separating what could happen from what's likely to happen, because you actually note in one of your slides here, you say that it's really going to actually be pretty difficult to unwind the U.S. trade deficit, given all the trade relationships that we've constructed over the past 35 years since Johnson, you know, with the global economy. We spoke about this with Michael Pettis just last week in terms of how complex the global economy is with just all of the supply chains. I mean, you can have one car that is constructed in 10 to 15 different countries, all the different parts that go into it before it comes to our border. And that can be true for a large range of different products. So reconstructing that overnight is not going to happen. So I guess the question is what are the limitations? Because to me, it seems like there are a lot of limitations here. And I don't know. I guess Trump is a businessman. I do want to point out, I didn't vote for Trump. I didn't vote for Hillary either. I actually voted for Lawrence Kotlikoff, who is one of our guests on our show, a regular guest, and he was a write-in candidate because I really liked his focus in terms of the amount of debt that we're accruing, the fact that Social Security is not solvent, and that we need to make some changes. So I really felt like he had the best economic platform that I could agree with. But that being said, I do think that there are a number of limitations that Trump is under. And sure, he could do something that causes a shock in terms of global trade. But I mean, how quickly can these things happen, even if he were to try to implement them?
As quickly as the next tweet, 140 characters later, and we could have a global depression. I mean, it's, again, Chris, it's fine to hope that he's not going to do what he promised to do. I mean, let's all hope that he doesn't do what he promised to do, the thing that got him elected. But I think that's far too optimistic.
Well, hold on, Richard. Let me say this. There are some things that you agree with Trump on, and I know one of them in particular is infrastructure. That's something we've talked about on the show with you many times, is that you think we do need to see a massive infrastructure program here in the U.S. And it's not just that we need it for the sake of economic growth. We need it just for the sake of the fact that the American Society of Civil Engineers is giving us a grade of a D. And the next report card, who knows? We might be failing when we look at America's infrastructure. And I'm sure that's also the case in parts of Europe as well. So we do need to see infrastructure. I know that you agree with him on that. So in terms of fiscal spending, he's proposed $1 trillion here. The American Society of Civil Engineers, they say that we need over $3 trillion. So it's not even matching what they say we need. But let's talk about some of the things that you do agree with Trump. And then also, I want to bring in your YouTube video where you actually talked about what President Trump can do to make America's economy great again. So let's talk about some of the positive things that you think he could implement and may actually do.
So yes, I encourage President-elect Trump to go forward with his plans on infrastructure spending, but also for him not to just stop with building roads and bridges. What the United States needs is very large-scale government investment in new industries and new technologies so that we can restructure the U.S. economy. And so what I have in mind is over the next 10 years, the government could spend, for instance, $1 trillion investing in solar energy, $1 trillion investing in nanotechnology, another trillion in genetic engineering, another trillion in biotech. If that's the kind of investment that we can afford to do. So yes, go ahead with the infrastructure spending and at the same time, invest in new industries and technologies. If we do this on a large enough scale, then we can induce a new technological revolution that would restructure the U.S. economy.
Well, Richard, I want to point out that a lot of the things that we discussed today are once again available on our site, financialsense.com. If you want to look at the presentation that you gave titled Trump's Recipe for Disaster, and also you provide a series of different videos at richardduncaneconomics.com through MacroWatch. What are some of the topics that you're looking to cover perhaps in the weeks and months ahead at MacroWatch in case any of our listeners would like to sign up and watch some of them?
Well, Chris, I upload a new video every couple of weeks, and so I'm able to cover quite a broad range of topics. For instance, I look at the global economy, and what matters most for the global economy is first, what's happening in the United States, and second, what's happening in China. And that's what makes this time so fascinating, is because policies under our new president could be and look likely to be radically different from the policies that we've seen over the last 2.5 decades. And they have the potential of crashing the entire global economic structure that has been built up in the post-Bretton Woods era under the dollar standard, our current international monetary system. If he eliminates the current account deficit, then that means that there'll be fewer dollars flooding into the global economy. So global liquidity will dry up. That alone is enough to create a serious economic slowdown, if not recession. And of course, if the president does carry through with his promise to eliminate the current account deficit, well, this is going to have catastrophic consequences for China. China's trade surplus with the United States is $1 billion a day. If you take that away, if we eliminate the U.S. trade deficit with China, then the consequences for China are going to be devastating. Their economy is already verging on economic crisis. Now, remember back in 2008 and 2009, when the U.S. went into crisis, imports into the United States fell significantly. So Chinese exports to the United States also fell significantly. And the headlines then were 30 million Chinese factory workers lose their jobs and have to go back to the countryside to work in agriculture, if they could find jobs at all. But at that point, that came nowhere near eliminating China's trade surplus with the U.S. So if we actually did eliminate this trade surplus that China has with the U.S., which Peter Death by China Navarro seems keen on doing, then China's economy would literally implode. There would be tens of millions of people unemployed. So consumption in China would collapse, and that would mean Chinese imports from other countries around the world would collapse. And so commodity prices would crash, but also investment in China would crash. And essentially, the banking system would implode, and the crisis would be potentially so severe in China that the Chinese Communist Party could lose control of the situation and lose control over the economy and the country altogether. Now, in the summer of 1941, the United States imposed an oil embargo on Japan. And less than 6 months later, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. So no one should underestimate the potential consequences, the dire consequences that could result from an economic collapse in China, the kind of collapse that would result from President Trump's proposed policies of eliminating the U.S. current account deficit. So these are all the kind of themes that I monitor and the sorts of videos that I make. And I do try to always make it, first of all, easy for people to understand the forces that I'm describing. But also, I try to make it clear how individual investors would be affected in terms of their investment decisions, their investment portfolios. So those are the themes that I return to again and again in the videos I make for MacroWatch.
Well, Richard, I guess on that note, hopefully Trump watches the video that you posted on YouTube. We do know that he likes to bypass the regular channels of mainstream media, posting his thoughts on YouTube and, of course, through Twitter. So he's obviously familiar with these channels. So hopefully he'll consider what you have to say there.
Thank you, Chris. I'll be standing by my phone waiting for the call.
All right, Richard. Well, take care and thank you for speaking with us again. It was great to have you on.
Thank you for having me back.
If you have any questions or feedback on what we discussed today or about Richard had said, whether or not you agree or disagree, please feel free to email me. You can do so by going to Financial Sense, clicking the Contact Us button, and leaving your comment for us. We always love to hear back from you. It makes a better show. We like to hear what you're thinking about FS Insider, about the guests that we're having on, and of course, any topics that you would like us to get into. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider at financialsense.com.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.